Hi, welcome back to Law and Legitimacy. This is Norm Pattis, your host, episode 27. It's been a while since I've recorded. Last I did was a long-form interview of my good friend R. Rex Paris, mayor of Lancaster and trial lawyer extraordinaire, as well as biotech investor and climate change advocate. I'm back in Connecticut now, and I want to thank once again Mike Boyer of the Carolina Craft Legal Group. He was kind enough to narrate an episode or two from old blog posts while I was out west conducting depositions and visiting family. Yes, it's true. I'm going to be a grandfather again for the third time. My daughter, who shall go unnamed for her privacy's sake, will give birth sometime in the fall. I am rooting for the name Norm or Norma. That should cover both the genders that we customarily regard as popping out of a mother's womb. I don't know what we can do if it's one of the other genders, Normette, Normina, but I suspect she'll have a name of her own. In any case, Mike was kind enough to continue to shepherd this project through to the goal line, and he remains a good and dedicated friend. Thank you, Mike. So, one of the guilty pleasures of a business trip, especially a business trip out west, is long periods of time in airports and on airplanes. These are busman's holidays for a reader, and I like nothing better than to pick up a good book, lose myself in it for a day. It makes the time pass and it enriches the soul. I read a couple on the flights, and one I want to talk about today, George Orwell's 1984. The book was first written in 1949, and I think all of us read it in school. I read it in college, or perhaps graduate school, a lifetime ago. And I often hear reference to Orwell's 84 as prophetic or prescient, foreseeing the times we live in. Indeed, a good client of mine, Alex Jones, often says the antidote to 1984 is 1776. In other words, a return to first principles should be sufficient to stare down the face of tyranny as it blossoms. But here's the question. What would happen if we were to interview George Orwell today? How well does 1984 stand the test of time? What themes in 1984 resonate with a world in which we have big tech censorship and big tech control of the means of communication? We don't have one-party rule. You know, Orwell wrote fables, including Animal Farm, that made a satiric mockery of communism or one-party rule. But what do we have today? And what could Orwell's 1984 teach us about the human spirit and about dignity? Let's talk about that, shall we? 1984 was published in 1949. At that point, 1984 seemed a long way off, and the Cold War was beginning to take shape. The world had survived the First World War, the cataclysm of the Great Depression, and then a Second World War, resulting in the deaths of tens of millions. The Soviet Union had taken shape, and the dictatorship of the proletariat had given rise to a different sort of dictatorship, one-party rule, that was gathering steam and seemed to propose a credible alternative to life in the West. Orwell was afraid of collectivism and wrote 1984 to expose what he feared about the dangers of collectivism. The novel is the story of Winston Smith, an outer party functionary in the Republic or dictatorship or state of Oceania. In Oceania, there are three classes of people. There's the inner party, the party elite, the outer party, that is party functionaries who do the day-to-day work of the party, and then the proles or proletariats, some 85% of the population, the unwashed who aren't indoctrinated by party dogma, required to toe the party line, but are simply harnessed as a cheap and easy source of energy and labor. It is far from a collectivist fantasy. It's a long way from Marx's Republic, where something is, where each gives according to his talents and receives according to his needs. It's not even the planned economy of Joseph Stalin. What it is a totalitarianism of the spirit, where the party controls the contents of minds and thereby the behavior of people. Winston lives in the Ministry of Truth, which is really the Ministry of Lies. It is the function of the Ministry of Truth to construct a narrative that supports the party at any given time. This can yield quick rewrites of history when events change, when an economic forecast, for example, that once called for the production of, let's say, 100 million shoes fails, and 80 are produced, the Ministry of Truth will rewrite history such that at the time the prediction of 100 was made, they'll actually make it look like 60, that 60 million Jews were called for. Thus, 80 is a miracle of production. Doublespeak is the means by which people can accommodate inconsistent truths at the same time, and they do so out of a sense of survival. And at the cost, Winston learns and struggles with, of human integrity. One of the party's dicta, or controlling doctrines, is the following. Who controls the past, ran the party slogan, controls the future. Who controls the present, controls the past. In other words, information is power, and the Ministry of Truth teaches people what intersubjective statements can be safely made. And the party member's loyalty and prospects are directly tied to his or her ability to utter and ultimately believe those truths. Orwell wrote without any real inkling of the power of mass communication in the electronic age. He was concerned about the power of mass society and about control of the print media and how it was that control of the print media could yield to control of people. In this way, his book, which is bleak and dark in the extreme, is over-optimistic. But listen to what he says of the invention of print. This comes from a mock history written as part of the propaganda effort in Oceania. The invention of print, however, made it easier to manipulate public opinion, and the film and radio carried the process further. With the development of television and the technical advance which made it possible to receive and transmit simultaneously on the same instrument, private life came to an end. Every citizen, or at least every citizen important enough to be worth watching, could be kept for 24 hours a day under the eyes of the police and in the sound of the official propaganda, with all other channels of communication closed. The possibility of enforcing not only complete obedience to the will of the state, but complete uniformity of opinion on all subjects now existed for the first time. Yeah, okay, I get that. That was the fear in the 50s and 60s of mass society. We saw writings about that in the works of men such as Marshall McLuhan. But what Orwell didn't get was how important computing would be, cloud computing and the internet. So, for example, in Big Brother's world in Oceania, everybody had television sets, and you could never tell whether the television set was watching you or not. It had to be on, and you received notices from the party and news and some entertainment. At any given moment, however, the screen could bark at you, and it would be watching you, and you didn't know when it would watch or when it wouldn't, and thus the terror. You had no privacy. You had the sense of being totally surveilled. Orwell got it only half right. We do live now in a time of total surveillance where our devices watch us, where our devices harvest our data, and where big data makes it possible to track each and every one of our movements all day, every day, for an entire year. And that data is sold to advertising agencies and probably shared with the government, such that the fantasy of total control, or at least total surveillance, is no longer a fantasy. It's now a reality. Orwell was made to look a little more optimistic than he could have been about that. But what are the consequences of that, and how do you assure orthodoxy? This is where Orwell looks like a genius, and he understood something that social media now has perfected. Control in Oceania was manipulated in Oceania by manipulating people's feelings, in particular, fear and hatred. They had hate weeks. They had two-minute hates during the day or during the week. And at these points, the people would be gathered together in common rooms or common areas, and their rage would be directed at common objects, and they would share the experience of collective rage and the creation of a sense of orthodoxy. Isn't that what's going on to some degree with our social media now? We no longer have a community of minds gathering together in a public square to debate ideas about facts commonly accepted. Today, we all live in news silos. Cable has us divided into tribes, podcasts, and electronic communications are catered to taste. And social media manipulates us by focusing on our darker emotions because that's what makes us click. That's what makes us stay on or like an item. And thus, we are induced to give information about ourselves to a distant overlord on the basis of our baser or less or more primitive responses to data. In other words, we've become what we hate, and we are tribes united in our hatred of disparate things. This is not one party control, I get that, and so Orwell's vision falls flat. There is no party that controls us or that owns us, but there's a fear that there could be. You know, I listen from time to time to Alex Jones, a client of mine on InfoWars, and I wonder what he's talking about when he talks about globalism, and I wonder whether it isn't, in effect, the aggregation of big data and the conglomeration of big tech, the big tech bros, as it were, into a unifying force designed for the purpose of controlling us and maximizing profit from our economic decisions at the margins. If Orwell were alive today, I suspect 1984 would be a darker book than it is, and it is plenty dark. I mean, there are rays of hope. When he writes of the proles, for example, the ordinary people who are beyond the reach of the party, I see hope. Here's one of the things he says. They were born, they grew up in the gutter, they went to work at 12, they passed through a brief blossoming period of beauty and sexual desire, they married at 20, they were middle-aged at 30, they died for the most part at 60. Well, you know, you travel through working-class America, and that description probably fits for the most part. But the cost of this wear and tear on the human psyche was at least that the psyche remained intact, and that these were people filled with integrity and a sense of significance. Here's what Orwell wrote later of the proles. They were governed by private loyalties, which they did not question. What mattered were individual relationships and a completely helpless gesture, an embrace, a tear, a word spoken to a dying man could have value in itself. The proles, it suddenly occurred to him, had remained in this condition. They were not loyal to a party or a country or an idea. They were loyal to one another. For the first time in his life, he did not despise the proles or think of them merely as an inert force which would one day spring to life and regenerate the world. The proles had stayed human. They had not become hardened inside. They had held on to the primitive emotions which he himself had to relearn by conscious effort. In other words, the proles remained human and bound to one another and to themselves by a sense of integrity, but more significantly, and I don't mean to be tautological here, by a sense of significance. And this was, to me, the best part of rereading 1984. You know, you read social philosophy, you read the partisan debates, you look at popular culture, you look at Western intellectual history, and what drives so much is a striving to know what it is that humans want. In other words, you know, what is human nature? What is it that drives us? What is it that motivates us? I think in Orwell's 1984, the image that emerges is what drives us, what motivates us, what sustains us is the quest for significance. We all want to matter. We want to be at home in the place we reside. We want to be with people who recognize us for who we are and cherish us for our idiosyncrasies. And we want to cherish the idiosyncrasies of another, not so that we can be right in some broader perspective or pass an existential litmus test of what makes for a good human being, but we want to be good enough for one another, and we want to be cherished for who we are, and we want to cherish the spark of life in another. So the quest for humanity, or humankind's quest, is really nothing more than a quest for significance. And that's what makes Winston Smith such a compelling figure in 1984. He is suspicious of the party. He hates the party. He doesn't like being manipulated, but he has no reason to believe that there's anything else, except for his memory. His memory reminds him of times, or recalls to him, or calls to light times where significant fundamental truths were changed at the snap of a finger, on Big Brother's order. He once found a newsprint article that suggested that three individuals executed as enemies of the state could not be guilty of the crimes they committed because they were elsewhere, and their confessions were therefore false, and their trials were show trials. And these tiny shards of integrity provoke or prod or poke at Winston Smith in such a way that he cannot yield internally to Big Brother. And this is both his saving grace and his destruction. because he's human, he wants to love and to be loved. And soon he finds himself in the arms and in the heart and in love with Julia, another outer party worker. They find secret places where they can have assignations outside the eyes of Big Brother. They have a secret room where they can retreat for a few precious hours from time to time and indulge in the illusion that significance is enough, that being significant to your lover, being significant in the eyes of another, is no crime. This is, of course, a crime the state cannot tolerate, because the collective demands the total obedience, the total devotion of its subjects, and the party then becomes the ultimate reality, the reality against which every trifling emotion must be measured. And to the degree that a person diverts its glance or his glance or her glance from the goals and objectives of the party, the collective order is imperiled, and it cannot be tolerated. Winston tries to join the resistance. He believes that there is a group of individuals who, like him, cherish idiosyncrasy, cherish significance in the eyes of one another rather than in the eyes of the state. And thinking he's being recruited to join this, he once takes a sort of loyalty test. And he's asked the following questions. Are you prepared to give your life? Yes. You're prepared to commit murder? Yes. To commit acts of sabotage which may cause the death of hundreds of innocent people? Yes. To betray your country to foreign powers? Yes. You are prepared to cheat, to forge, to blackmail, to corrupt the minds of children, to distribute habit-forming drugs, to encourage prostitution, to disseminate venereal disease, to do anything which is likely to cause demoralization and weaken the power of the party? Yes. If, for example, it would somehow serve our interest to throw sulfuric acid to a child's face, are you prepared to do that? Yes. Are you prepared to lose your identity and live out the rest of your life as a dock worker? Yes. Are you prepared to commit suicide if and when we order to do so? Yes. Then the ultimate question, because he's asked these questions in the presence of Julia, the two of them take this interrogation together. Are you prepared, the two of you, to separate and never see one another again? No, answers Julia, and no answers Winston, because at that moment he would have lost the sweetness in life. The image of himself in the eyes of his lover and the image of the lover in the eyes of himself, that intimacy which makes life bearable, which yields the ultimate sense of significance, a sense of acceptance, utter acceptance by the other. It's a powerful and gripping portrayal of love. I mean, it's true, Orwell was a journalist, not a lyrical poet, and his portrayal of intimacy sometimes has the feel of having been strained through a cheese grater. but the point is that in terms of what motivates humankind, you get the sense that Winston found what he needed in life in Julia, and likewise Julia, and they were prepared to risk all for one another. And they did risk all for one another. Now, in the end, the state wins. O'Brien, the shadowy figure who Winston thought was recruiting him to the resistance, turns out to be a member of the Ministry of Truth and the Thought Police. And Winston goes through a brutal interrogation. The last part of his book chronicles the overcoming of his mind, spirit, and body, and his breaking. And in the end, he feels that he has betrayed everyone, even Julia. He's told the state all the secrets he could about her, what she liked, what she disliked, where they met, how they met, what they did. He even recounted the manner in which they'd been intimate with one another. But as he says to O'Brien at one point, you know, I've never betrayed her. I've never betrayed the love I had for her. And O'Brien knew that to be right. And until that could be broken, Orwell was independent and a threat to the state. And so he was taken to Room 101. What Room 101 was a place where an individual was forced face to face with his deepest, darkest fear, that sense of whatever it is that inspires each of us in the dead of night with a sense of disgrace, horror, and disgust, what it is you would avoid at all costs. For Winston, it was being placed in a cage where his face would be gnawed by rats, and as the contraption was attached to his neck and he could see the fetid creatures raging at the cage to get at him and to gnaw at him, he said, don't do it to me. Do it to Julia. Put Julia in here. Please, please, please. And he begged O'Brien to do so. And it was at that moment that O'Brien knew that Big Brother had won, that they had broken Winston, that he had sacrificed everything that he had, including his love, including his intimacy, including his sense of significance in the eyes of the other, and he was broken. But he still was not to be discarded. He wasn't executed, because Big Brother was all about power. And then, and O'Brien tells him, you know, the problem with every other utopia prior to ours is that they pretended power served some larger end rather than an end in itself. But in Oceana, what was important was the boot on the neck and the recognition of the fact that absolute power had no justification, no need for a justification other than its own existence, and that the best way to express that absolute power was to break the individual and to make the individual love the boot that crushed him. And so the transformation of Winston from an independent person seeking significance into an abject and sniveling creature of the state would not be completed until he came to love Big Brother, until he found his sense of significance in the collective whole, and that there was nothing that remained of him any longer other than what could be manipulated by the state. And the novel ends with Winston expressing his love for Big Brother in the most improbable ways, improbable of ways, rather, when there's yet another stunning reversal in the news, and what was true yesterday suddenly became false today, and the embrace of new truths immediately doublespeak without a moment to reflect on the dissonance of embracing simultaneous and inconsistent thoughts at the same time, was replaced with blind obedience and love of Big Brother. Winston, in the end, is broken. He betrays himself, and he betrays his sense of significance. I was stunned by how much the discussion between O'Brien and Winston in the end reminded me of the Grand Inquisitor in Dostoevsky's Brothers Karamazov. You know, Winston holds out for a vision of human integrity, of truth, of independence, for a spirit of liberty. And much like the Grand Inquisitor, O'Brien says, you know, that's not really what people want. What people want is a sense of security, and they'll sacrifice everything to get it. And in the end, Winston did sacrifice everything. Where does that leave us? You know, I really don't know. I mean, people who talk about 1984 talk about it as a sort of antidote to collectivism and a reminder of the importance of the human spirit, but I wonder how many of those people have read beyond the first two chapters. In the end, big tech, big bros, the state, the party won. And an individual seeking security and identity with the larger group was sacrificed entirely and broken in the most brutal means to serve the collective. It sort of reminded me of what I fear, at least in our time. You know, suddenly we have a republic of virtue where public health authorities know what's good for us on every dimension, and the state is to be empowered so that we can live a good life. We can be set free in spite of ourselves. We can live the collective dream that serves the species, that serves the group, that serves humankind in a hostile world as we confront climate change, this, that, and the other thing. Orwell reminds us that there's something untidy about the human spirit and that our collective lives are chaotic. And perhaps they're supposed to be. Perhaps that's the only way for them to be, for us not to lose our own sense of significance. In the battle for survival, no one gets out of here alive. And while the party or the species may endure forever, and, you know, in an era of existential threats, that's not clear, it's not at all obvious to me that the cost of collective survival is worth the breaking of any individual human spirit. So I read 1984, and I mourned for Winston Smith. I moaned a little too, I suppose. I was on an airplane, so I didn't moan aloud. And I mourned for us today. We live in a world where we are easily manipulated, surveilled, and controlled. The overlord is not the party. The overlord appears to be big tech. In the eyes of some, it appears to be the forces of globalism. I do think there's no denying that there are collectivizing pressures that place enormous stresses on every individual seeking significance in his or her own way. On my morning walk today, I was encouraged to see that a local family has now decided to sell roadside seedlings. They've started something called the Hope Family Farm, and for a dollar or two, you can buy a kale plant that they have planted for themselves from seed and transform it into the ground yourself. And somehow this small vision in the handshake economy gave me a sense of significance that I know Winston Smith would have appreciated. It's not big tech, it's not big agriculture, but it's one human being reaching across the divide that separates us, hope from hope, aspiration from aspiration, and gives us the possibility to warm our own souls in the heat generated by the soul of another. 1984 is about individualism and its death. It's a timely book. I encourage you to reread it. I'd love to hear what you think about it. Thank you for visiting Law and Legitimacy. And if you like, give me a 5-star rating. You can support the effort on Patreon. You won't find Law and Legitimacy on Patreon. You'll find Norm Pattis there. I'd appreciate your support because in the dark of night, I can't help but suspect that Big Brother is coming for us all. And I mean to be independent until the very end.